Welcome to YMF Connections. It's been a while since our last episode, and YMF has undergone quite some change in the past few years, and we'll talk about these changes in upcoming podcasts. In this episode, we feature an interview with acclaimed cellist and educator Daniel Rothmuller. In his 36 years as associate principal cellist with the Los Angeles Philharmonic, Daniel has worked with the who's who of legendary musical directors, such as Zubin Mehta, Carlo Maria Giuliani, Andre Previn, and Esa-Pekka Salonen. He's been a featured soloist in concert halls across the world, including the West Coast premiere of Witold Lutosławski's Cello Concerto and H.K. Gruber's Cello Concerto, the latter performed under the baton of the composer. Rothmuller is a noted teacher and pedagogue, and has served on the faculties of the USC Thornton School of Music, California Institute of the Arts, Cal State Fullerton, and the University of Northern Colorado. Daniel Rothmuller has dedicated his life to making art at the deepest levels, and sharing his keenly observed, uniquely personal process and perspective with mentees, students, and lovers of the musical arts. He shares all of these beautifully and movingly with us here in this episode. In the studio with us today, we have Mr. Daniel Rothmuller, and we're so pleased and honored to have you here at the Connection Studio. Danny, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
I've been a fan of your career ever since I've been in Los Angeles. It's an honor and a thrill to have you here today.
Well, I'm very happy to be here, and I feel very honored that you asked me here.
So let's start at the beginning, because you have a very interesting origin story. Why don't you tell us, Danny, about where you were born and the process that brought you here?
My parents, my father was an opera singer and very well renowned in Europe, and he finally came to America and sang at the Met, and sang in all the major opera houses, most of the major opera houses in Europe and South America, and generally in the United States, and he even sang in Mexico. He had a very big career, and I imagine one of the biggest influences of my life. It translated to me as something that helped me become a musician and produce my own sound on whatever instrument I was playing. But it did not transfer over to my brother, who played trombone in his school orchestra, but did not really have a talent, or I think the propensity to appear on stage as a musician. He was the brains of the two of us, and he became a scientist, a physicist, and very successful scientist.
So what was that like? What was your household like? Your father's a famous opera star. Were there just musicians coming in and out all the time?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I didn't realize what was happening. When I was born, I was born in Zurich, Switzerland, when my father's job was to be the baritone of the Zurich Opera at that time, which was a very, very wonderful place to be because that was all during World War II. And it was just serendipity that my father was there. He auditioned for it in 1932 or 33, and he happened to be in a German opera house at the time when he auditioned for the Zurich Opera. And at that time, it wasn't well known by the Jewish community that what was happening was happening. And so he did not take the Zurich job because of escaping Germany. He took it because it was a better gig. Lots of wonderful things were happening in Zurich. It was a very innovative opera company. They did a lot of new opera. They did, contemporary pieces. They did the whole repertoire, and they had really a wonderful orchestra, and great conductors would come there. My father got to sing Matthias der Mahler with Hindemith conducting, and he sang Frau ohne Schatten with Richard Strauss actually conducting it. Wow. And so he Zurich was quite an interesting place to be born. I'm not sure about my brother, but I had absolutely no clue that there was a world war going on. I was born in 43, but there were these strangers coming in and out of our house. And I found out later that a lot of them were Jewish refugees that we were helping, because Zurich was a gateway to go in and out of Germany. And we had a Jewish community there that helped refugees.
Well, how fortunate for your father that he took the better gig, and how fortunate for you and for all of us. You know, fortune was most certainly smiling on your family.
I feel that my whole life. I don't understand why, but I've been very fortunate my whole life.
Well, things happen for reasons, I think. I just want to just take a pause and remark, interesting that your father was an opera singer. In my opinion, and I've certainly read this, that the cello has often been called the closest instrument to the human voice.
Well, it's interesting that you would say that, because when we emigrated to the United States in 1949, came over under Queen Mary, we were in New York for a while, and then my father was hired by Dean Bain at Indiana University of the Indiana University School of Music, and he became professor at Indiana. And so we all moved to Bloomington, and it just coincided. I had my bar mitzvah in New York, as a good Jew should be in New York, and I had already become a United States citizen in Brooklyn, New York, so I was really kosher. And so we moved to Bloomington, Indiana, which I thought might have dirt roads and horses. But then I realized when we got there, of course, we found out it was one of the most civilized towns in the world. At the time we moved to Bloomington, I was a bass player. My bass teacher was on one side of my father, and my future cello teacher was on the other side of my father. And my father would say to his students, "You should sing like a cello, because a cello is what you want to emulate." And of course, my cello teacher said, referring to the next door neighbor, you should play the cello like a singer. Yeah. So we exchange, and I think one of the basic reasons for that is because the cello lends itself to melody. The first thing when you tell anybody who doesn't know you well, when you tell them you're a musician, say, "Oh, what do you do?" And you say, "Oh, I play the cello." He says, "Oh, the cello, it's my favorite instrument." And the reason for that is the voice of the cello.
And it communicates to people in a very sort of direct and evocative way, I think.
Yeah, it is very, very human voice. It's a very human voice, and I think that's its biggest strength.
What attracted you? Was the bass your very first instrument?
Yeah, I was assigned to play the bass.
You were assigned?
Yeah, I was the smallest kid in grade school, and they needed a bass player, and I got assigned to play bass, and they gave me a book, and Simondal 1, which had pictures that I could... I had no teacher, and I just figured it out all by myself.
What age was this about?
I must have been maybe 9, 10 years old. Got a half-size bass, and thank God a French bow, because I was small, and I just looked at the pictures and followed the pictures. I had a good ear, fortunately. I also knew the basic piano notes, and we had a piano in the house, of course, so I knew how to read music.
And did you teach yourself how to read music?
I just gravitated to the piano, and I figured out where C is, and it's the same thing with children as with language. Music and foreign languages, which music is a pretty foreign language to a lot of people, to read it at least. And so when you're that little, you can figure anything out. My father took up, he's a Middle European opera singer who became fascinated with a home repair. And he had built himself up a shop in our basement, which rivaled probably any lumber yard. And so he loved to build things. We actually redid our house. My brother and I were the two slaves, and my father and a contractor. And we literally renovated our home once, one whole summer. My father was famous for being the only person that anybody knew in the arts that was fascinated with woodwork. I hear Starker saying you should really take that bass and take an axe to it. That's all I heard. And I ran away upstairs to my room. I was in tears, devastated by this famous cellist telling that I should chop up the bass. When my mother was wondering where I was, and she came looking for me, and I was in tears, and I told her what I heard, and she started laughing, and which I thought was completely inappropriate. And so she said, well, you didn't hear the rest of what he said. And I said, well, what was that? You should chop it up and make it into a cello, because the guy is a cellist. He's not a bass player. My father said, you are now a cellist. And I was very unhappy for a whole year. I got a few bass licks in. I made a deal, and I said, "Well, I want to audition for the Indiana University Philharmonic, which was an unbelievably great orchestra. It was probably the greatest, better than the Juilliard Orchestra or the Curtis Orchestra. We had a huge music school, and so there was a great pool of talent to pull from. And I was in high school. I was a junior in high school. I auditioned. It was a real orchestra audition, sight reading, everything. I had to play Don Juan. And I guess I was one of the few string players who was one of those people that was known for playing solo repertoire and winning competitions that way, that loved playing orchestra. And I've never not loved playing orchestra, even as a converted cellist. I'd always dreamt of playing in an orchestra, and chamber music was central to my life. So in playing solo, I was fortunate in that in my life too. So the deal was I got to play one semester in the IU Philharmonic, and it was kind of embarrassing for the faculty and for the conductor, because apparently I played better than the graduate students that auditioned, because everybody had to audition. Wow. It was a good training place for orchestra musicians. So anyway, so I got my jollies out, and I said, okay, now I'll take up the cello, and the rest is history.
Now, up until that point, you got in to the university orchestra at 17. Had you had a teacher by that point?
When we moved to Bloomington, I got hooked up to Murray Grodner. You have to understand that almost all our instrumental faculty, almost all of them, were alumni of NBC Symphony Orchestra under Toscanini. So we had horn faculty from the Cleveland Orchestra under Zell. We had, it was ridiculous. Our tuba player was William Bell, who was a legend, who played at the NBC Symphony Orchestra, and Joseph Gingold, who's one of the concertmasters, and Primrose, who was one of the first violists. You know, I mean, it was unbelievable. As a friend of mine and I love to say, when we left Bloomington, we felt like we left the womb, and we were burned for that. We actually said it in a Washington Post interview. I mean, we couldn't believe the mediocrity that we encountered once we left Bloomington, because Bloomington was like this bell jar of talent and great teachers, great information, no nonsense. It was all authentic, the real deal. And then we went out in the world and we saw all this diluted information. That was a golden age in Bloomington. I was there for the whole 60s. You know, I was in Bloomington from 56 to 67.
Thinking back on that, what is the thing that you think drove you the most? Was it your instructor? Was it your desire to play in the orchestra?
God, I hate to say this. I was just a show-off. From my early age, I liked to be the center of attention. Well, of course, all babies and young kids, if they have any kind of feel like this, they like to be the center of attention. I remember being in junior high school in New York, and they wanted people to perform. I said, oh, I'll do something. And I didn't prepare anything. I just walked on stage with the bass, with my bass, which at that time I finally graduated. I was big enough to have a 3/4 size bass in, just before we moved to Bloomington. And I jammed, and then I played a few licks of certain solos I'd learned and twirled the bass. That was when I started my twirling career, because I'm famous for twirling the cello. Anyway, so that was my first twirling experience. I just was extemporaneous. So I've always been a seat-of-the-pants kind of guy, and I've somehow avoided catastrophe. The thing is that my desire for excellence never wavered. My teachers always emphasized nothing but excellence. There was no compromise with taste. There was no compromise with intonation. There's no compromise with tone quality. There is no such thing as almost. And it was normal for me. And that's the key, is excellence has to become normal. I was just fortunate. I've had all these great teachers and then these maestros that I've played under, where I don't forget anything they say. I know when it's authentic and when it's not. There's an alarm bell that goes off, mainly because I've been around all this authentic stuff before. So when I see somebody winging it, I go, oops, you know, don't listen to anything they have to say from now on. It's like I used to have this rule. I learned this very, very early in my life. If somebody lies to you, don't take for granted that anything else they ever have to say after that is the truth. It probably is the truth, or it is the truth, but it's all suspect from then on. Because if somebody lies to you, then you don't know when it's the next time. Right. And for me, misquoting a piece, misquoting a professor, misquoting what you read, putting a spin on it, that's for me lying. And music and the arts deal in truth. And it's the only thing that matters. It's truth. And I like to explain to my students that music is nothing more than an art. And art is nothing more than an expression of the human condition, period. It's all it is. It's that's why we understand some artists, and sometimes we don't understand other artists, because we can't understand how they're expressing themselves. But it's no less valid. So there isn't any really bad art if it comes from a genuine place, and also hopefully from a genuine talent to be able to interpret the human condition. But that is all art is. All writing, all sculpture, all painting, all music, all architecture, all anything that is considered art and that is bona fide art is simply an expression of the human condition. And that means everything. Yeah. It means all of nature, all of everything that we've ever perceived. And if somebody understands that, I can always tell when a student understands it, then all of a sudden they have a different feel of what they're actually doing, that music actually is supposed to express something in particular. And I tell them, you know, there's nothing inappropriate if you express something. You might be not expressing what the composer was thinking at the time, but at least you're saying something. And if you're saying something, that's what the art is about. If you're saying nothing, if you're just playing notes and trying to echo something, or if, God forbid, you emulate somebody, that's unauthentic interpretation, where you borrow from somebody else. You can't really borrow somebody else's thoughts and feelings. You have to, if you're an artist, it has to come from somewhere inside of you. You, of course, will learn from other artists. You course, we'll be influenced by our artists. But I can't tell you how many times people, in my experience as a teacher, have listened to a CD and just kind of copied what they heard.
If I can just interrupt and circle back to something. To anybody listening to this podcast right now, the last 5 minutes of what Danny has said is probably the most, in my opinion, probably the most important thing you will ever hear about being a musician and being an artist. I have to say, in my experience, what you just said so succinctly is so incredibly rare that you don't get from most academic encounters or even most teacher-to-student encounters. It's all wrapped up in the technique. It's all wrapped up in the careerism. But to get to the heart, and that's what you're talking about, is the human heart, to make that connection, and that's the name of this podcast, that is the thing, and that is what communicates, and that is what greatness is. And if it's not that...
It's not art.
And please, I mean, replay that. Right now, replay 5 minutes back and listen to what Danny said again. Clip it out of the sound file and transcribe it. I can't tell you how important that just was. And this has been one of my favorite moments right now doing this podcast, because you've gotten to the essence. And it's true what you said too. It's for all art. It's for all art. And that is what art is. Thank you for that.
I thank my influences throughout my life that made me come to that. It's so important to surround yourself in the right environment. You know, some teachers are good for some students. Some teachers, the same teacher, might not be good for another student. All these things are very, very important to understand as a student and just as a listener of music. You need to have some kind of knowledge to appreciate what you're hearing. Whenever I have a student who's studying, let's say, a Beethoven cello sonata, for instance, I ask them, the first thing I ask them is, what do you think Beethoven's instrument was? And if you know, and they all know, it's the piano. I said, how many piano sonatas do you know of the 32 piano sonatas? And he said, well, let's see, I think I heard the Waldstein and of course, the Moonlight, mm-hmm. and they come up with like three usually. You don't know Beethoven. So I say, look, if you're studying a Bach suite, you've got to listen to keyboard works, organ, harpsichord, well-tempered clavier, whatever, until your ears are bleeding. Because you've got to train your brain to understand the mind of the composer. And if you want to understand Beethoven, you've got to at least know a dozen piano sonatas from the middle, the early, middle, and late opuses really intimately well. Just immerse yourself into the composer, and then your life is changed when you go now back to the cello sonata and you start practicing it. You now have in your brain Mr. Beethoven's brain. If you're not used to listening to German and to Viennese dialect or to Hoch German dialect from Berlin, the Hoch German will help you in Beethoven's and Brahms quite a bit, but you need to get some of the Viennese dialect in there, because they both heard that. And a composer's actual language that they spoke has a lot to do with what they heard. If you want to play French music, you should kind of know the melody of the French language really well. You don't have to actually speak French. You just have to get used to hearing the language. And you can, I love to imitate. I imitate Chinese. I imitate Japanese. I don't speak any of these languages, but I don't offend anybody by it. But when I fake it, they say, "My God, you've got the sound and of the intonation of the language, the emphasis, the accents."
We were talking earlier, and I was saying that one of the themes that keeps coming up, and what I know to be true, in order to have a successful career as a musician, you have to prepare yourself. You say it comes easy to you. I think because you don't have to work as hard as maybe some other people, but perfect practice.
When you practice, one of the most important things is to practice such a small amount that you can get it right now. If you just learn to play one note and then play the next note and then put them together, you've learned something. If you try to do a bunch of notes and you keep trying to do it and trying to do it and do it a little slower and do it, I don't know what, you know, different rhythms, if you can't put two notes together, you've got to learn one note, and then you have to learn two notes, and then you learn three notes, and then you learn four notes. The same thing goes with rhythm and bow strokes. You've got to learn to do it right the first time. And the rule that goes along with that is you have to get it right consecutively a certain amount of times, and I refer to this expression of success quotient practicing. You give yourself a number. The initial number is 3. And I have to do whatever I'm trying to do right at the moment. I have to be able to do it 3 times in a row with absolutely no perceptible, up to this point of knowledge, mistakes. It's in tune, it's good sound, right rhythm, you know, and it has to be 3 times. And then I always go odd numbers, 5 times. Then I go from 5 to 10. I give myself these tests because I found that students, what they do very often is they'll attempt something again and again and again, and finally they get it. And this is when I stop them in their tracks and I confront them so that they're like deer in the headlights and said, do you know what you've just done? And they look at, yes, I learned how to play the passage. I said, no, 9 times you learned how not to play the passage and 1 time you learned to play the passage. In other words, you learned how not to play the passage. Because the ratio of success has to be the other way around. If you do it 9 times in a row really great and you know, screw it up once, you're more likely to be successful that when you perform, there is no second chance. That's it. Nobody plays perfectly. Absolutely nobody. That's what, we're human beings. But we give the illusion of perfection. And we are kind of illusionists. We're magicians. And if we've prepared really well, we not only will bring the audience into our world of art and how we see a particular piece, but we'll also give them the illusion, hopefully, that we didn't do anything wrong, that we didn't make a mistake, even though we probably have. A really great performer is a person who either can see trouble coming or is experiencing a problem and can fix it on the fly. That skill can only come from success quotient practicing. If you've done it so many more times in ratio of success and failure, if your success rate is really up there, percentage-wise, you have a much better chance of correcting things on the fly because you're used to being successful. If you're used to success, you can travel in that rare air because that's what you breathe. I learned at a very early age, because I'm basically an incredibly lazy person as far as practicing is concerned. I really, really hate practicing. And I found that a lot of talented people really don't look forward to practicing. It's not a joy to practice because I see it as facing myself. Mm. And there's nothing more horrifying to me than facing myself and my weaknesses and my foibles and my not being able to do something right away. I hate that. I really, really feel sorry for people who waste their time when they practice, because it's heartbreaking. Mm. Because then when they perform, it doesn't work. And I can always tell when somebody's practicing effectively. You know, it's like you want to be able to play something with one hand tied behind your back kind of philosophy. You want to be able to, because many of my colleagues and even some music directors have said, very rarely would you be at a performance that you have to play where you're on this in the spotlight, where everything is ideal. Mm-hmm. You might not feel well that day. You missed your train. You missed your plane. It's too humid. It's too dry. There is never a time, I don't remember a good performance of mine where I felt, okay, this is great. The performances I'd like to forget, because nothing happened. And something has to happen for me, feeling it and feeling the audience getting involved. So ideal situations never happen to a professional performer. It doesn't exist. And so you prepare yourself for the worst.
The way you practice, the way you focus, the way you concentrate, whether it's one note connected to another, not being relaxed, but being fully engaged. That's hard.
It's very hard. The other thing, apropos the thing about learning one or two or three notes, I sometimes tell a student, you should be practicing when you're learning a piece and it's very unfamiliar to you and it's very difficult for you to learn, and it's a famous piece, Dvorak Concerto or something really famous. Somebody walking past your practice room who is not a cellist should not be able to understand what you're practicing, because it's so taken apart and so x-rayed from me inside out, an MRI of a piece, that you can't even tell what the piece is. You might recognize a note here or there, and only a cellist who has practiced well will walk by that room and say, oh, they're doing a Dvorak Concerto. To be a smart person is to solve problems. And that's what you're doing in a practice room. And one of the other rules, two other rules I have about practicing is, number one, you have to be your own best friend. You have to be the understanding, terrific, wonderful best friend that you ever had in your life. That's number one. When you're in a practice room, never beat yourself up, never get angry, always console yourself and figure out a solution. And the other very important thing when you're practicing, besides being your own best friend, is to be the greatest pedagogue that ever was born. You have to become incredibly clever at solving technical problems. And my illustration of that always has to do with the people who composed etudes. All of them were virtuosi on their instruments because they came up with their own solutions. They're the ones that wrote all these things. Sevcik and Klengel and Schroeder and Simandl and, you know, all these people wrote all these exercises down for themselves. And then they imparted them, and they were also pedagogues. Everybody who's practicing can be a Sevcik. You have to try to become a pedagogue when you're in a practice room. You have to be brilliant, and you have to come up with solutions, and you might come up with a solution that nobody ever thought of. I remember one of my dear, dear colleagues who I always looked up to in every way, Ronald Leonard. He said, patience is really, really important when you're practicing. When you're practicing, you have to give yourself a chance. If you don't work at it in a sane, patient way and become irrational and emotional about solving a problem, you're destroying not just yourself, but, you know, the karma around you. Yeah. You're destroying your world. And you want to create a world. You don't want to destroy a world. So you have to be positive when you're in a practice room. You must be your own best friend, be the greatest pedagogue, practice success quotient practicing so that you can guarantee to a great extent your ability to actually come up with a product.
Training your mind the way you're talking about with, I mean, you're training, of course, your ear, you're training your fingers, yeah. and but you're training your mind first and foremost.
The brain.
And it's a kind of focus that is not typical to our daily existence. We are walking around running scripts in our heads, worried about tonight. And so to focus like that it's creating a picture for me that I'd never thought about it in that way. Practicing, that it's as much as training your mind as it is training anything else, because it's true. If your mind is this tool, and if your mind is this, you're going to be okay up there on that stage. You're going to be okay in that audition.
Right, and some days it's really tough going.
Right.
I mean, you know you have to get in that practice room. You really don't want to, and you're not looking forward to it, either because of the piece or you're just not in the right mood or whatever. But that is what professionalism really comes down to, is that you're doing it because that's what you do. Professionalism, Peter Gorski also said something very interesting. Somebody once asked him something like, I'm not sure what the situation was, but what is it like being a professional musician? And he immediately stopped that train of thought immediately by saying, a professional musician? What do you mean by that? He says, well, that's your profession. It's also my hobby. And he says, I'm an amateur who gets paid. Because he considered something amateur is because you love to do it. An amateur has come to mean being a second rate, doing it for fun, play with people who are not very good, and, you know, amateur chamber music players and amateur this. And he brought it back and he says, no, amateur means you do it for the love. And that's what amateur means. And professional literally means that you get paid for it. And not all professionals are amateurs, but there are quite a few amateurs that are professionals. And they're the best artists. I always envy people who are amateurs in their profession, because I'm sure there are teachers, there are scientists, there are people who have professions who really don't love what they're doing, but they do it because they're trained to do it, because that's the way they earn their bread and butter. The people that should really be envied are all those people making their living doing what they love to do. It's not just race car drivers. It's physicists and school teachers and guys who build buildings. Usually they go into that profession because they're interested in it. But if you love it, then it becomes a whole different ball game. So I never didn't love music. Nobody in my family, there's nobody that doesn't love music, whether they play something or they're a professional audience member. There's nobody in my life. I am not interested in knowing anybody who doesn't love music. And I know so many audience members who just live to go to being an amateur and being professional. It's I feel very fortunate that I always loved what I was doing.
This has been Connections, a podcast by the Young Musicians Foundation with special guest Daniel Rothmuller. We have many more exciting new episodes to come with a considerably different format. So please keep checking in with where you get your podcasts and be on the lookout for future episodes of Connections. Special thanks to Bruce Broughton for this theme music.